Hello and welcome to Network Europe. Coming up on the programme, when doing the right thing goes wrong, we look at why six French charity workers are being investigated for a mass kidnapping in Chad.
We don't know about what's happening later, and sorry, but we don't care. We have to do something now, and now it's to go there, to come back with them.
Some thoughts on how to celebrate Independence Day in Poland. EU lawmakers tell Germans their apple wine isn't wine. We hear what some Germans think of that. And it's supposed to be women who have to deal with discrimination, but try being a man in Sweden.
For example, anything having to do with kids. That's a great area where there is female dominance.
All of that coming up on this week's edition of Network Europe. This week from Hilversum in Holland with me, Richard Walker. A few weeks ago, a group of French aid workers was arrested in Chad as they attempted to take just over 100 local children back to France. They were members of L'Arche de Zoe, a charity that had been planning to evacuate children from the war-torn Darfur region of Western Sudan. The question on many people's lips is, what were these charity workers doing? They're now under investigation in Chad. They'd spent all summer recruiting French families to be hosts to what they said would be orphans from Darfur. UNICEF has since confirmed that most of the children on the plane to France were in fact not orphans, and most are probably from Chad and not Sudan. RFI's Sarah Elsis met with members of the L'Arche de Zoe organisation this summer, as well as possible host families, and a short while ago she told me about the motivations of the people involved in a case of doing the right thing gone wrong.
This group was talking about evacuating orphans from Darfur. They were talking about getting them out of the conflict zone and bringing them to France to be taken in by host families here in France. Their conclusion, having gone to Darfur, and there are some of the members of the organization, was that nothing can be done on the ground. Humanitarian aid is impossible to get done there. What we need to do is get these kids out of there and be taken in by families in France. Now, initially, they had kind of talked about adoption because they were sort of trying to recruit families who may have been interested in adopting, but they realized that, you know, that wasn't going to work so well because, first of all, I mean, it's illegal to adopt children from a Muslim country. But then they were saying, well, the kids will come, they'll be refugees. After a few years, they can become French, and then they can be adopted as French citizens. But eventually they were telling me that most of the families who ended up being interested in being host families were people who were interested in doing it for humanitarian reasons. And you can hear this clip. It was recorded, I recorded this in July, this man, Jean Riotor, he already has three children, and he explained why his family wants to be a host family.
There's most definitely a personal motivation. We'd like to make ourselves useful. Our children are getting older, and we'd like to do this, especially if it's to help someone who's living in poverty.
Well, I mean, I think each family is going to have an individual reason, but at least this family, it struck me, it seemed like they were very, very much convinced by what the organization was telling them, that there is no other option for these children, and they really wanted to help. And in fact, I went to a march last Sunday where families got together. They showed their support for the organization. I met one woman who even said, you know, at least the kids are safe now. You know, they're being taken in by the UNICEF or whatever in Chad. For her, it didn't matter if the kids didn't make it to France, you know, so you have that kind of reaction too. And I must say that even now that all of this controversy has come out and this affair has come out, these families still have this overwhelming support for the organization. They want to know what happened, though. I mean, there's a lot of questions, but they still really believe in the good faith of this organization. In fact, here in this next clip, you can hear the same man, Jean Riotor, speaking last week after he found out about what happened in Chad.
Des doutes, incontestablement. Nous avons besoin de connaître le déroulement exact de l'opération.
We definitely have doubts. We need to know exactly what happened during the operation. I think the members of the association are prepared to answer for their actions. They just need to be able to defend themselves, but within the context of a presumption of innocence.
So there's cautious support from the families in France, but several denunciations in Chad. This whole affair has sparked protests against humanitarian actions there, hasn't it?
With
President Idriss Deby initially accusing the organisation of paedophilia and organ trafficking, which sounds ridiculous, and I think the West...
And he's since retracted that, of course.
It sounds like an overreaction, possibly related to they're worried that they're being treated like a colony again. Is that what's going on here? Is that why these people have been arrested?
Well, I mean, they've also been arrested because they had a plane load of 103 kids. And, you know, it's come out that these kids weren't orphans, that they had parents. So there's definitely something that happened here that shouldn't have happened. And there's definitely, I think, a very justified outrage. Now, the question is, what was the actual motivation of the group? And that should be coming out in the investigation. From what I gathered meeting them, I think that they just weren't really thinking beyond the immediate consequences. In fact, in this clip, you can hear Émilie Lelouch, who's a member of the organization, one of the detainees. Here she's talking about what would happen after the kids were in France, assuming they'd get here, which actually never happened, of course. But you can hear in her the sort of same sense of not really thinking beyond the operation.
We don't know about what's happening later. And sorry, but we don't care. We have to do something now. And now it's to go there, to come back with them.
From that, it sounds like the organization sees itself as on a heroic mission.
Definitely. And I think, you know, there's reports coming out. The journalists who were let go, they've been talking to the media and we can hear their reports. And in fact, you can hear the president of the organization, Eric Proteau, who's still very much convinced that what he was doing was right. He's convinced that the kids were orphans, that he got guarantees from people on the ground. I mean, he's completely saying, I'm taking full responsibility for what I did, and I still think what I was doing was completely right, was completely legal within the context of international human rights law and refugee rights laws, and this is the only thing that we can do. So, you know, again, I don't think we can't call them child traffickers. We can definitely call them naive, and definitely not very clear what the ramifications were diplomatically and such. And I guess now we'll just have to see what happens as they get investigated on the ground in Chad.
A story we'll be following in the future, no doubt. Poland celebrating its independence on November the 11th. It's a day to celebrate after more than a century of invasions and partitions for the country. This is a day of official ceremonies, but ordinary people aren't celebrating as much as you might have imagined. Michael Kowicki of Polish Radio's External Service has been trying to find out why.
This year's Independence Day celebrations have a particularly solemn character. Over 13,000 Polish officers, victims of the Katyn massacre in Stalin's Russia in 1940, receive posthumous promotions during the 40-hour-long ceremony at Warsaw's Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, culminating on Independence Day itself. It's an unusually long event, as military protocol requires that all the names of the promoted officers be read out. Ewa Juńczyk-Ziomecka, a minister of state in the presidential chancellery.
That there is no individual in Poland that they have any doubts that this tragedy that was manipulated for so many years needs to have a clear place in a Polish memory.
The Katyn massacre remains an open wound for Poles and a thorny issue in Polish-Russian relations, in view of the fact that Moscow still refuses to acknowledge that Katyn was an act of genocide. It was surely one of the key events in modern Polish history. But November the 11th is a joyous occasion, the day when Poles celebrate the regaining of independence in 1918, after over 120 years of foreign rule. Why are there no street parades or joyous celebrations, therefore? The autumn weather may not be suitable for open-air events, but as Marek Magierowski of the Rzeczpospolita Daily says, this is not the only reason.
I think that our independence is strictly related to martyrdom. We consider ourselves as martyrs. It's hard to celebrate martyrdom.
For many Poles, organized parades have bad connotations.
Parades and street parades are associated in Poland with the communist regime. And to celebrate a day like Independence Day, like you celebrated Communist Days celebrations, wouldn't be a good idea.
Over the past few years, things have started to change a bit, with the authorities in several cities organizing open-air sing-alongs of patriotic songs. Being proud of your national heritage is a good thing, says Janusz Cisek, the director of the Polish Army Museum in Warsaw.
We have many reasons to be proud of our history, especially when you see that our independence was very costly, and yet every generation was trying to get it, just to have this opportunity of wearing the Polish flag, of celebrating national unity, of being able to see a white eagle being presented on such and such occasion.
The mood in Poland on Independence Day is not likely to become similar to that of July the 14th in France very soon, but journalist Łukasz Warzecha is among those who hope that the solemn atmosphere of the day will not be its permanent feature.
I think this will change with time. And what is very striking for me is that if we have veterans who fought in, for example, 1920, very few of them still live, they are very glad to see joyful parades and joyful celebrations. They want that mood, not the gloomy mood. And this is something that I think is very good, and we should listen to them.
Sweden is the poster boy of social progress, isn't it? Or is that poster person? It enjoys one of the world's most advanced welfare systems. Swedes live longer than almost anyone else. And Swedish prison cells are nicer than the average European budget hotel room. But has progress gone too far when it comes to the emancipation of women? A new book suggests Swedish women are conducting their campaign for equal opportunities at the expense of men. How else, you might wonder? And the book even claims that Swedish men are the victims of outright discrimination. Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiros reports.
Vi måste kämpa tillsammans alla, vi får inte för gamla myter falla.
Per Ström does not mince his words in his attack on feminism.
This era of feminism has created a climate in society where the general opinion is, oh, women are having problems and are below, in some way, men in society. I claim that there are several other areas where men have problems, and that is not spoken about.
Per Ström of the independent think tank, Den Nya Välfärden, is a well-known participant in the Swedish media debate. He claims widespread oppression of men is going on in the name of feminism in Sweden. He has just published a book delivering a scathing criticism of the feminist movement in this country, which he accuses of using Machiavellian means to silence any debate on the issue. But how has feminism hurt the male cause?
For example, anything having to do with kids. That's a great area where there is female dominance. They have a much stronger situation, for example, after a divorce and when there's a dispute about who should take care of the children.
You also seem to be saying that the issue of equal opportunities is not well balanced.
No, that discussion is very, very female-oriented, where problems of women are seen all the time and discussed all the time. Problems of men are not discussed. They are more or less considered non-existent.
My first reaction is it's quite strange that he has written a book in opposition of feminism without really understanding what is feminism.
Rebecca Bolin is editor-in-chief of the labor-oriented newspaper Arbetaren and is also active in the feminist movement.
When we met, I asked him, did you read any feminist book? And he said, well, to be honest, perhaps I've read one. I agree that there's a big problem in society that women are supposed to take care of the children. And we get this organization and questioning from men, mostly after they are divorced and they want to take the custody of the children. But I think that's a very narrow picture of the problem. I think we must have a broader perspective and talk about the responsibility of both mother and father from the start.
And one of the things he says is that the feminist movement has created a situation where men's problems are neglected.
Would you agree with that?
In some part, there are men's issues that are neglected. For instance, depression is such an area. It's more likely to get a treatment for a woman with depression than for a man. That is something that is included in the feminist discussion, that there are gender imaginations about sickness.
Per Strump says he has a number of examples to show how men are discriminated against. If Swedish feminists are really interested in real equal opportunities, he argues, why are they then silent when it comes to the absence of women in some sectors?
In Sweden, we have the draft for men. Women don't have to do any military service because there's an exemption in the constitution of Sweden. That's one example of how it's easier for women.
And I agree with that. That is really crazy. Of course, it should be young women and young men.
We have a climate where we're supposed to all the time consider women as the underclass, which must be helped to promote them. And I claim that on other areas, men are the underclass.
That sort of argument has angered Sweden's feminists, and Per Ström himself is well aware that his book has not made him the darling of the feminist movement.
I do not expect to be popular among them.
You're listening to Network Europe with me, Richard Walker. Now to Germany and the storm in a wine glass over apples and the definition of wine. Apple wine, known in Germany as Äpfelwein, has a long and rich tradition in the state of Hesse. Last week, Hessians were outraged to discover an EU proposal to define wine as a product only made from grapes. Faced with this potential rebranding as an alcoholic wine-style apple-based beverage, Hesse's state premier, Roland Koch, leapt to the defence of his state's favourite drink.
Apple wine, or Äpfelwein, as it's called in Frankfurter dialect, has been poured down thirsty Frankfurt gullets, at least since the early 1600s, when an apple wine purity law was passed that's still in force today. The law means that Äpfelwein must be made from 100% apple juice, with no added sugar, water or carbonation. It has around 5% alcohol, and it's a pure natural product, says Johanna Höhl from the Hessian Apple Wine and Fruit Juice Association.
We only use apples, and these primarily come from traditional style apple orchards, where the trees aren't fertilised or sprayed. Then these apples are pressed and the juice fermented, which means wine is made in an absolutely natural way.
A staggering 80% of Germany's apple wine production is consumed within a 100-kilometre radius of Frankfurt. Legend has it that it was the corpulent Emperor Karl the Great who discovered the drink when he accidentally sat on an apple and squeezed out all the juice. But, says Johanna Höhl, there is a more rational explanation for this local tradition of apple wine.
In the middle of the 1600s, there were a whole load of vineyards here, and then the great phylloxera, a pest related to aphids, turned up. And there were also some climactic changes, and the vines around Frankfurt just gave up the ghost. At the same time, the city expanded, and people started to plant apple trees to feed the increasing population.
After being a thirst quencher for more than three centuries, apple wine is today very much part of Frankfurt's cultural identity. There are Äpfelwein festivals and fairs throughout the year, Äpfelwein poetry competitions, and there's even a tram, the Äpfelwein Express, that tours Frankfurt's tourist sites and numerous apple wine pubs. Many of these apple wine taverns even refuse to serve other alcoholic drinks. And how the apple wine is served is also strictly regulated by tradition, as Ellen from the Zum Feuerrädchen Tavern explains.
Here people usually order apple wine in a jug called a bembel. That's a stoneware jug in a sort of grey and blue design. And the glasses are called gerippten. They've got a kind of diamond pattern cut inside of the glass and outside. And they're kind of typical.
German apple wine is quite different from English cider and French cidre. It's sour, sometimes bitingly so, I have to admit that I prefer wine of the grape variety. But in true Hessian style, my friend Andy isn't daunted by the prospect of drinking the Bembel on his own.
Let's put some in. Yummy, looks very good. It's got a golden colour. Well, I personally like to drink it pure, whereas other people mix it with sparkling water. Or you can mix it, well, some people do that, you can mix it with lemonade, but purists say you can't do that at all. I don't really care. I love it pure and simple. Cheers.
Kate Hairsine, Deutsche Welle Radio, Frankfurt.
Ask any Czech to name the country's most famous beverage and your answer's almost certainly beer. Not only do Czechs drink more of the stuff per capita than anybody else, Czechs are also very proud of their brewing history, which includes the world's original Pilsner. For 4 years, a polling agency has been mapping the Czechs' relationship to beer. The latest results were released last Wednesday. Radio Prague's Jan Wellinger reports.
Ah, beer. What could be more typically Czech? This week, the chairman of the Czech Beer and Malt Association, Jan Veselý, was among industry insiders who welcomed the latest independent findings by the CVVM agency, an annual survey on Czechs and beer. Among the findings, a number of revelations as well as a confirmation of more long-term trends. Of the latter, the survey suggests most Czechs value their beer history. A full 99% of the 1,000 or so polled agreed beer was an important part of Czech culture. 94% said it was something to show pride in abroad, and 78% were of the opinion Czech beer was the very best in the world. To a degree, many pubgoers here won't drink anything else. The CVVM agency's Jiří Vinopal.
In general, Czechs are very conservative drinkers because they favor their 1, 2, 3 marks of beer or labels, and are not very willing to change their habits.
To a tiny degree, that is changing. According to the survey's findings, those with stronger purchasing power are growing more willing to experiment with different or lesser-known brands, both Czech and foreign, and breweries are taking notice, introducing more high-end products like special dark beers. In all cases, Czechs, both men and women, cite taste as certainly one of the most, if not the very most, important factor. The survey was not without some negative results. Despite general pride in their beer tradition, 67% of Czechs polled indicated that the high consumption of beer in the Czech Republic is not always something to be especially proud of. Czechs are also self-critical, realizing that some probably drink too much. On the other hand, the survey suggests that positives outweigh the negatives, and there are no doubts that beer will continue to play a strong social role in everyday Czech life. Jan Veselý, once again.
I think it's very important everywhere. Everywhere in Europe or Atlantic area, Europe and States and Canada, to meet people, to be with people, to contact with them in a ring of your friends.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's Network Europe. This month's quiz is all about music, and there's a medley of three pieces of music on our website, www.networkeurope.org, which if you can identify the titles of correctly and then mail to me at contact@networkeurope.org, you may win a moderately coveted prize. That's all from me here in Hilversum in Holland. I'll be back next week, but for now, from all of the Network Europe partners around the continent, thanks very much for listening.